Welcome to the latest episode of Your Wealth with Gemma Dell, a podcast series designed to help you create, grow, and protect your wealth.
Hi, and welcome to Your Wealth. I'm Gemma Dale, NABTrade's Director of SMSF and Investor Behaviour. Today's episode is going to be a little bit different. It's going to take the form of a story and perhaps some lessons from that story. Many of you, our listeners, will already be familiar with Cufflinks, which is an incredibly high-quality, free weekly investment newsletter for retail investors. NABTrade publishes a lot of Cufflinks content, and Cufflinks also publishes some of our content about super and tax and markets and investment strategies and many other interesting topics. The publisher of Cufflinks is Graham Hand, who has spent decades working in banking and finance, in capital markets for CBA in the 80s, for Treasury at the State Bank of New South Wales and NatWest, before becoming a highly respected consultant and commentator. Now, about 5 years ago, Graham wrote an exceptional piece for Cufflinks called What Did You Do During the GFC, Daddy? Which I think is the best title. And it talks about his experiences of managing a very significant credit book a good 12 months before the financial crisis really reached the front pages. I loved this article when I read it. I still love it 5 years later. And we're now about 10 years on from the collapse of Lehman Brothers, which is really the event that brought the GFC to people's attention, the general public's attention, and it impacted investor portfolios across the world. Graham's here to tell us about it.
Thanks, Gemma. It's great to be here.
So, Graham, set the scene for us. 2007?
Yeah.
This is all happening.
Yeah. You're right that people think about the GFC as starting in 2008. In fact, 15th of September 2008 is the date people quote. So, we're about to see a lot of 10 years on stories coming
up in a few months.
Mm. Yeah. And yet, if you were involved in the credit markets or the borrowing markets, the date that you're more likely to remember is the 9th of August 2007. And there followed an extraordinary series of events in the next year. But it was the events of that night of 9th of August 2007 which are most ingrained in my memory.
Mm. Okay, well, tell us all about it. So what was your role at that time? What were your responsibilities? What were you doing?
At the time, I'd been working for Colonial First State in what was like a mini treasury. Colonial First State had products which were geared funds where the gearing was internal. And the way the product worked is an investor would put in a dollar, Colonial First State would borrow a dollar, and $2 would be invested in the fund.
Mm-hmm.
And because the markets had rallied very strongly between 2002 and 2007, these funds had $10 billion in them, and the borrowings were about 55%, so we had about $5.5 billion of borrowing. So it was like a mini bank, and $1 billion of that was borrowed in what was called the euro note market. So borrowings were done in the short-term European markets almost every night to roll over, say, 50 or 70 million of this $1 billion every night.
And so why did you, I'm not a credit market expert by any means, why did you have so many small notes? You didn't have big tranches, you were doing lots and lots of small issuings.
Yeah. It was really a desire to find the cheapest funding wherever it was in the world. So the program would borrow in Australia from banks or in so-called commercial paper, and then we did this $1 billion in Europe. And you know, every night, maybe 50 million would roll over.
Right, and that was a fairly straightforward.
Yeah, it was very straightforward. In fact, we didn't even talk to the dealers in London most nights. We would leave with them a level. We would say we're happy to issue at this particular rate. They would do it as long as that rate would be met. We would come in the morning, and it had just rolled over.
It had been done.
But this particular night was different.
So tell us about that night.
Okay, so that night, as you know, Australia is whatever 9 or 10 hours ahead of Europe. So I'd gone home. It's like 7 o'clock at night, and the phone rings, and it's a dealer from Citibank. And we had $50 million of paper due to roll over that night. And he said to me, we haven't been able to find any buyers for the paper, so we won't be able to roll it over. And I thought when he said that, he was just using this as a negotiating ploy, right? Mm. And he was just wanting us to pay maybe 3 or 5 basis points more for the borrowing.
Mm.
So I said to him, based on my 30 years of experience, so what will it take to roll it over?
Yeah.
And he said to me, Graham, you don't understand. There are no bids at any price. Now, that is an extraordinary thing, because that in itself is, in my experience, was unprecedented, because one of the lessons you will learn is that, you know, the price will clear the market.
Yes. There's always a bid at some price.
There's always a bid at some price. Okay, so what had happened? Mm. You know, what had literally happened in those 2 or 3 hours? Well, that was really the start of the subprime crisis.
Mm.
And BNP Paribas had announced that morning that one of their cash funds, so a fund that just invested people's cash, was suspending redemptions. So this is just like a cash management trust. You know, you think that you've put your money in and you get your money out the next day.
Mm.
But they were unable to value the assets, because the underlying assets were these subprime securitized assets that they had bought. So they didn't know what the assets were worth. They were suspending redemptions. And at that point, Europe realized something's happening here.
Yeah.
And everyone stepped back from the market.
So just to reiterate for anyone who's not across it, and it's 10 years now, there have been plenty of fabulous documentaries and papers written on this. And so many people will be familiar, but the subprime crisis was really low quality lending for housing in the US.
That's
yeah.
Right.
The fabulously titled Ninja Loans.
That's the one.
No income, no job, no assets.
That's right.
Don't lend to those people. But they were lending to those people. And if you watch some of the films, The Big Short or that Margin Call was another one. The Big Short's quite marvelous.
Exactly.
Go to a house of ill repute and and all the staff have 3 or 4 investment properties.
That's
and
right.
This sort of things. So quite extraordinary things that were going on in the US. And you were saying at this point, this is when the market in Europe realized that dodgy lending in the US had started to
And cross so the remember, edge. This is August 2007, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so this is still a year before Lehman. And the amazing thing about this borrowing program is that at that stage we had $1 billion. And when an event like this happens in financial markets, the first thing that you say to yourself is, well, this might be over in a couple of days.
Mm.
Okay. And so it's not sort of, oh, panic, what are we going to do?
Yeah.
It was just $50 million of a $5.5 billion program. So I just said, okay, we can't roll it over. You know, no worries, we'll speak tomorrow.
Mm. Okay.
That $1 billion, not 1 cent of that rolled over again. We never had any bids in the life of that program. And 3 months later, we had repaid $1 billion and we never issued again and we canceled that program. So it
oh
was,
my goodness.
It was not the loss of just that amount of maturity. Mm. The market for that sort of short-term paper effectively closed. And so, you know, the sort of lessons that you learn about sources of funding, diversification, clear a market at any price. A lot of those lessons just didn't happen. The market closed.
That's extraordinary. So one of the questions I was going to ask, and you've alluded to it, is, you know, had you ever experienced anything like it before?
It was a funny situation because, you know, I've been in markets for whatever it was, 25 or 30 years, and I thought that experience would stand me in good stead on almost whatever would happen.
Yeah.
But it was almost as if the market experience wasn't useful because it had never happened before. Now, what the market experience did do is that we had to, being a geared fund, if the market does fall a bit, you do need to repay some of the debt anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And we did have some other sources in Australia. So if you like, the experience came in holding on to the rest, and, you know, holding on to what we, using all sorts of tricks and experience. So some of the things we did in Australia, I mean, I'll give you one example that we were part of the Colonial First State Group, and Colonial First State is a massive lender to the market because they were very big cash funds in the market. And so I would say to people who were giving money to the Colonial First, to the geared funds, if you don't continue to roll over the paper, then I'll go and see the guys who lend money to you and say, we're not going to be nice to you on the other side. Now, in fact, I really had no right to do that, because those fund managers are completely independent. They look after their own clients. But it was really a matter of, what can you do to hold this funding together?
And every
corporate in Australia would have been saying, what can we do to hold on to our funding?
To maintain the liquidity and keep things moving.
Yeah.
Again, next question. Yeah, how did you and your team respond? So really every trick you had.
Yeah, it's
and a few you didn't know you had.
Yeah, it's every trick you had. And what was really the thing that was all also interesting is, if you think about a sort of a dealing room, a fund manager, they have people who specialize in cash and bonds, and other people in property and equities. And there's this massive disconnect in the room. The people who are looking after the cash are saying, guys, the funding markets, the capital markets are literally falling apart. And if you look at the timing, the equity markets subsequent to that, reached new highs.
Yeah.
Now, they did subsequently fall away a little bit before the GFC. But I can remember discussions with bond markets and with some of the bond dealers, and they were saying, one of us is wrong.
Yeah.
Okay. Either because the bond markets is where credit and lending and spreads will often manifest itself first, but the equity market was ignoring it.
And still coming up with, you know, record profits and all of these things. So this is an interesting question, because it relates to both markets. And I'll relate it back to the experience that people have had since, which is, how could you tell, or could you tell, whether it was a wobble or the beginning of a crisis? And this is where 2 or 3 decades worth of experience may have helped.
Yeah. And, you know, this is a question that I think everyone has to ask themselves now, even when there's a short-term correction in the market. Now, As we know, we've had a rallying market now since, say, 2009, and although the Australian market hasn't recovered its previous highs, you know, the S&P 500 is at all-time highs, or close, and NASDAQ's at all-time high, but that's not been a straight-line journey.
No.
Somewhere along the line, the markets have fallen by, you know, maybe 5%, maybe even 10%, and at that time, you sort of say to yourself, Is this a start of a correction, or is it just a bit of a wobble on the journey? And you never really know. I mean, if you look at the last 50 years of the equity market, there have been 3 times where the market has fallen over 50%. Okay, so that's once every 15 or 20 years. And so I say to myself now, as an investor, or if I'm talking to people, say you have at least a 30-year investment horizon, and I think that someone who's 60 should think in terms of, say, 30 years. Someone who's 40 might have even longer. I would say to those people, sometime in that 30 years, I don't know whether it's next week or 10 years from now, the market will fall. It will probably, there's a good chance, it will fall 50%.
This is the equity market.
It's the equity market, are you prepared for that?
Yeah.
So to come back to your question, you know, what were the lessons at the time? The bond dealers were saying, those equity guys are absolutely crazy, you know, because, you know, the bond markets are selling
off. How can
they
not see what's happening?
How can they not see what's happening? They're sitting 5 meters away. And the bond guys were, equity guys were saying, you know, this is a bull run that's been running now since 2002. It's got a lot more legs. Sure, there might be a correction in 6 months' time, but it's not happening now.
It's not something we're going to be too concerned about. So one of the things in Australia, I had a unique experience, not unique, but in my career, a really interesting moment in 2006, 2007, that everyone who worked in superannuation and financial planning will remember, which is that the federal government, so it was Howard and Costello at the time, announced huge sweeping changes to superannuation on budget night 2006. So that was my night. I said, I'll cover the budget this year.
Okay.
It won't be too big. I'll stay behind and do it. Everyone else can go home. And I was there till 4 o'clock in the morning, because they released a 99-page document called The Future of Superannuation, or words to that effect, and changed the whole system. And one of the things they did was take underducted, as they were known, contributions super, so post-tax contributions, which had previously been unlimited, and put a cap on them for the first time. Yeah. And they proposed originally that it would be $150,000 per person per annum. They had a majority in the Senate as well as the House of Representatives, so when they proposed something, they meant it was going to happen. And everyone went mad. You know, I just sold a property and I'm planning to put the proceeds into super. You can't do this. So they released what was called the $1 million super opportunity.
That's right.
And with that, all sorts of people all over Australia suddenly realised this is their last big opportunity to get a big amount of money into super. Subsequent to that, there would be limits on how much they could contribute each year. So between 2006 May and the 1st of July 2007, so similar timing to what we're discussing, or just before, all of the financial planning industry, the superannuation industry, and everyone in these areas talking to retail investors were going around saying, this is your last opportunity to get money into superannuation and take advantage of tax-free withdrawals over 60, tax-free pension payments, all of these marvelous things that have now been legislated. Isn't this great? You need to make it happen. So all of these investors, we were talking to people every night, presentations in every RSL in the country, every leagues club, we did all of them. People were selling assets like property and taking assets that were outside superannuation and moving it into super. What is really interesting to me is that super flows, so money going into superannuation, increased by 30% over the year to 30 June 2007. That's enormous, given it's 9% of people's superannuation salary anyway. All of that money had to be invested after 1 July.
Yeah.
It went in cash. So 1 July 2007, huge swathes of money need to be invested that had never been in this environment before.
Yeah.
And you're telling me in August 2007, credit markets lock up. Mm. Do you think the Australian experience was particularly unusual? Like all this cash sloshing around?
I think it was unusual because you're right. I mean, I was working for Colonial First Aid at that time, and the inflows were massive. And I think that what also happened is because you'd had such a long bull run at that time, there was a sense of security about going into equities.
Mm.
You know, people didn't think that markets halved. You know, they think, oh, well, you know, it might have a small correction.
Mm.
And so a lot of that money, uniquely in Australia, because of that rule that you're referring to, did find its way into equities. And look, this is no sort of light-hearted matter. This destroyed a lot of people's superannuation savings, right? This was an absolute crisis time for people. And there'll be a lot of people who have in fact never recovered because they had such a poor experience. They saw half of their superannuation virtually disappear, but this is a year later when the Lehman thing happened, although markets did fall before that.
Mm.
And those people have since been gun shy. You know, they haven't wanted to go back into equities, and so they haven't experienced the subsequent rally. And so, you know, there's a big lesson of not putting all your money in at one stage.
It's quite interesting. Also, that was clearly a tax-driven strategy, right? It made a lot of sense to take advantage of it. The legislation's changed 10 years later, so they've brought back a lot of the rules in a slightly different guise, which is always interesting to observe. And people who've moved into that environment, as you say, you know, if you look at self-managed super funds, they have an enormous weighting to cash. It's 20-25% consistently in term deposits. You know, really conservative investments. Do you think they're taking advantage of your advice, which is, you know, what you're going to do when something goes wrong?
Look, I think if you look at the psychology of a lot of people, say you have $1 million invested in superannuation and you own your own house, you would think that I'm very well set up for the last 20 or 30 years of my life.
Mm.
And even when some of the superannuation is spent, I can go on to the age pension. So you've actually set things up to say everything's fine. And then initially there might be a market correction if you are heavily exposed to equities.
Mm.
And the 1 million becomes 800,000. Mm. And you think, actually, that's going to need a bit of belt tightening.
Mm.
Okay, that's not so good. But when the 800,000 goes to 500,000, you say, this is it, right? This is as much pain as I can take.
Mm.
If it goes to 200,000, I've completely compromised my life, the rest of my life, right? So at 500,000, they sell.
Yeah.
Okay. And that's the problem with having, say, too much exposure to equities, that, you know, you buy at the top and you sell at the bottom. And it's the difficult situation is that people do not know how they're going to react in a crisis.
Yes.
It's all very well to say, I won't do that. Mm. You know, I will wait it out. But when you actually look at your balance and you say, I can't stand it being less than this. Mm. That's when the problem hits, because you sell at probably the worst time.
So when Paul Clitheroe was on this podcast, and he made the point, which astonished me, but it should have been obvious, that the single day that Australians sold the most CBA shares of all time was on their lows on the 20th of March 2009.
Yeah.
And same with NAB shares, same with all the other sort of blue chip stocks. I mean, NAB shares were $16 at that point. And he was saying that was the day that they sold the most.
Yeah.
Which is pretty heartbreaking in retrospect.
Well, you know, being at Colonial First State, where, you know, you watch the flows according to what the market was doing, and you could almost see, you know, when markets are rising, when everyone's optimistic, the inflows are at their maximum.
Mm.
Okay, and I went to a presentation a few months ago from one of the biggest fund managers in Australia, and he put up a chart which showed that according to the performance of their fund, the better the performance of their fund, the better the inflows. Mm. And he was saying, in fact, you know, when our fund has had a fantastic run, you know, everything that we've bet has sort of paid off.
Mm.
That's when everyone invests.
Mm.
Whereas we feel, when the market hasn't realized how good the companies are and there's been a bit of a sell-off, that's when you should be investing.
Mm.
But it's all the sort of psychology of the way you invest and why you have to set up your portfolio to manage that.
To manage your own behavior and your own tendencies. Appreciating that we're all similar with this stuff.
Well,
Not as smart as we think we are.
Yeah.
I will say, for NABTrade investors, really interesting to observe that they are very happy to buy the dips for stocks that they like. So where they come off, they will happily buy those. And we see pretty consistent bargain hunting with our investment base. But that is buying at the margin. It's not your full portfolio, right? So it's interesting to observe. One, I guess, final question for you. Markets obviously were impacted around the world, and governments around the world had to respond. They had to do things, and they responded differently, partly with stimulus. So we had stimulus in Australia, which was actually very effective. Some question marks over where it was spent sometimes, but it was effective. We managed to, from an economic perspective, avoid the worst of the GFC. Maybe not from markets' perspective, but definitely from an economic perspective. In terms of how they've implemented regulation subsequently, do you think it has made markets more resilient?
Yeah, obviously you never know until this sort of unexpected crisis happens. And I do think the problem is, like, no one walks down the middle of the street waving a red flag saying, you know, next week the market's going to fall, and everyone has to make their own decisions. I think what you have to differentiate between the circumstances now and the circumstances in the GFC, if you think about in Australia actually at the time, one of the things that everyone was worried about is that there wouldn't be a bond market. You know, we had so many surpluses, we were paying off so much debt that people were saying, how do the capital markets function if you don't have a bond market? So we were in a great position to borrow money to build the schools and to build the roads and to pump prime our economy. So that's the first thing, that the finances of not only Australia but around the world were in better condition. But secondly, at the time of the GFC, the Australian cash rate was about 7.5%.
It was, yes.
And so you could stimulate the economy by reducing the cash rate. And all around the world, central banks were able to reduce rates. And as you know, ultimately, some even went negative.
Mm.
And so the current cash rate is 1.5%. Well, where'd you go from there? You can't stimulate anymore. And now the federal government debt is $500 billion.
Mm.
Now, there is a forecast that we'll start to produce some small surpluses. Mm. But, you know, we're now borrowing $500 billion. So the way the central banks responded, there just isn't the same sort of firepower. Now, having said that, you know, QE has made everyone comfortable, you could say complacent. So, you know, you could say, well, they'll do that again. And so if that's your view, then you might be more confident. My position would be to say, to set up your portfolio to still have a level of exposure to growth, but don't bet the bank, particularly if it's your retirement savings, on the fact that the central banks have cured the problem. Yeah. You know, that this time it's going to be different. So
the famous last words, this time
the famous lines. Mm. So I know that sort of diversification is a bit of a cliche, but I do think that, you know, spreading your investments, having some investments that are not correlated to the equity markets, you know, that will not fall when the equity markets fall. Now, of course, investing in cash and term deposits at 2 or 3% is really not going to help to finance your education, finance your retirement or your children's education, for that matter.
Yeah, you got that as well.
Got that. Mm. So you can try and find some fixed interest instruments which can earn more than that, but you don't want to go too far down the credit risk curve, because then they might struggle if there's a problem. But, you know, I would just say to people, don't be complacent about the fact that we've had such a good time recently.
Thank you so much. I remember the GFC extremely well. My husband and I were flatting together at the time, and we both work in the same industry, and it's different now. Obviously, you can look at it up on your phone and this sort of thing. We couldn't at the time. You get up in the morning and you watch the television and see markets had fallen 100 points or more. Yeah. Sea of red across the board. But that was 2008. So the fact that you had this experience in 2007, I think, is really powerful and very educational for people to appreciate that there was so much going on that perhaps we didn't switch on to.
Yeah, and the final thing I'll say is, if you think that you can sort of outguess everyone else, you know, that's going to be a pretty difficult thing to do. And if you know, if you say I will be able to sort of see the signs, well, that's going to be very difficult to do. I would set up the portfolio in anticipation of there being a problem
at some point.
Yeah, at some point, no idea when.
So Graham, one of the things that I also want to mention is, you know, these are the sorts of stories you tell in cufflinks. You've had these extraordinary experiences. The other one I love is your story about having guns in the Commonwealth Bank.
Oh, yes.
That's a brilliant one. How do people get access to cufflinks if they don't already have it?
Yes, so if people just go to cufflinks.com.au, that's cufflinks with an E, cufflinks. It's free. We try to tell people how to become better investors, how to allocate their portfolios. But and Gem has written many stories for us on you know, end of financial year, and we cover other issues like demographics and aged care. So we're not sort of stock picking. We're trying to make people into better investors.
You've got some awesome content on there. So
great
library of content. Then you can subscribe to the weekly newsletter as well. And you've got a very wide number of people who greatly appreciate what you have on there.
Great. Yeah, people can subscribe for free and they'll get our newsletter each week.
Graham, thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks very much, Gemma.
As always, thank you so much for listening to this episode of Your Wealth. We always love to hear from you. So if you have any feedback or suggestions for future topics, please just email us at yourwealth@nab.com.au. I'm Gemma Dale. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for listening to Your Wealth with Gemma Dale. To stay up to date, please subscribe to this podcast series or email us at yourwealth@nab.com.au.
Please note that any advice provided in this podcast has been prepared without taking into account your objectives, financial circumstances, or needs. Before acting, you should consider the appropriateness of the information. To find out more, please visit nab.com.au.